So, Professor Alam, thank you very much for the kind introduction. My name is Srđan Vučetić. You're probably wondering, okay, that doesn't sound Canadian. Where is he from, really, right? Yeah. I'm from Bosnia. Now you're probably wondering, some of you at least, okay, is he Muslim or not, right? That's what you're wondering. Yes, but partly. Bosnia is a very multicultural society, right? Bosnia, at a certain time in the 1990s, cities in Bosnia had more mixed marriages than New York City, which means that I'm Muslim and Christian and other things, right? So that was the understanding of multicultural Bosnia back in the times of Tito and Nehru and whoever. Bosnia is a very different society right now. Unfortunately, a de facto partition society. And I talked to some of you before my talk. I came here earlier just to see the compass, to see the general area. And I walked into some of you. I think one person right there, yeah. Yes, and we chatted about Bosnian politics, and I was impressed what the knowledge was. It was very high. And this young man here, Zaid, right?
Zaid,
knew the entire history of the conflict, which really impressed me. So this is one reason why I want to come to Jamia. Another one is concepts of language discourse and political communication. I've been told, even before I came to India this December, that if you want to discuss political communication, political rhetoric, you know, learn about discourse, talk to people who study these things, come to Jamia. I understand this is the premier place in this country to study these things. So I was very excited on multiple grounds. And on top of it all, I got to meet no less than 9 faculty members just now. Such welcome I've never received anywhere else before. All right, so this is not a topic of a book or an article or anything like that that I have written myself, but it's certainly something that I like to teach. In a class called American Foreign Policy, I assign a following essay assignment. Is the United States declining or not, and so what? Question mark. All students have to write on this topic. Tell me what decline means. It's a story about power. How do we conceptualize power in international theory? And who cares? Is this something we should be concerned about? Is this something we should be happy about? Right? Those are the kinds of questions I want my students, master's level, to respond to. All right. So what's this decline all about? As you know, it's one of the most topical topics of discussion, if you like, in Washington, D.C., but not just in Washington, D.C., in many other capitals of the world, in which, you know, the United States plays an important role. So certainly in New Delhi. So how do you introduce a topic like that? You usually start with an observation. 2004, 2008, the United States was here. 2013, the United States is here. This is a British think tank, demography, specializing in demographics. It's called the Legatum Institute. I study them for another reason. Here they have something called the Prosperity Index, right? How prosperous are nations? And think of it as a Gini coefficient, right? So relatively similar to the Gini coefficient. Essentially, it measures everything from the economy to health, to security, to education, on a number of, you know, reasonable aggregate measures, puts them together, and ranks countries. So according to the most recent prosperity index figures, the first most prosperous country is Norway, right? Followed by Denmark, Sweden, you get a lot of Scandinavians, you get a lot of small states, kind of like Singapore. And then very, very, at the very bottom of this particular snapshot, you get the United States. So in 2008, the United States was fourth on this very index, right? This is sometimes seized by media as a fact or obvious empirical observation of the U.S. decline, right? We've done so well in the past, then we went to this horrible recession, and now all of our standards of living are falling in terms of competitiveness, in terms of productivity, in terms of any reasonable measure. You know, we're not doing as well as we should be doing. As for other countries, they seem to have went through recessions in a much kind of more confident manner. Okay, so that's the argument. This is the media would put this argument forward. You know, we're not doing so well. And then what happens? There's a certain neurosis. It's called declinism. We're in decline. We're not doing so well. Now, I want to treat decline, since this is Jamia, as a discourse, right? Structured practices of communication that shape political outcomes, right? So when you think of declinism, it's about observing America's changing place in the world. But it's actually a much more complex, I would argue today, a much more complex discourse. And it serves one of the key functions. It's actually one of the key rhetorical devices in American political development since the beginning, whatever the beginning is. So there are three meanings, I would say. This comes from James Fellows. He's a wonderful student of arms trade as well as American politics, and really one of the grandees of, I would say, punditry and scholarship on American politics. So there are really three meanings. Is America falling apart? Is America falling short? Or is America falling behind? Often they're conflated, and they're obviously related one to another. But they mean very different things, and they have very different functions, politically speaking. Okay, let's examine them in turn. So falling apart. Who's arguing that America is falling apart, and why? Have you seen this graph before? This schema. Jesus Land versus the United States of Canada. I come from Canada, so I had to include this representation. This came in 2004, when George W. Bush won the second election, right? So it's very improbable. And every liberal in the United States was saying, oh, this is a disaster. We're moving to Canada. We can't, you know, take this 4 more years of this man. The United States is clearly declining. Someone, not sure who, this was one of those memes from the, you know, someone on the internet, came up with this, right? Actually, why don't the blue states, the states that voted for Kerry, join Canada, and all the red states, those that voted for Bush, form their own country? And then you would have some kind of a conservative Republican Jesus Land in the South, and the United States of Canada, which would happen to be the largest and the first social democratic global cop superpower in modern history. How exciting would that be, right? These arguments are always tongue-in-cheek, right? It's so impossible to conceptualize or even, you know, think of American disintegration. We talked about various kinds of disintegrations earlier. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to the United States of America, no one is walking around making an argument, you know, is going to fall apart the way that people walk around and make arguments that China will fall apart or India will fall apart or any other country. Very few people do. And when they do, the response is what? Ridicule or kind of, you know, funny representations of this type. Here's another example. Have you seen this map? In an absolute world. It's a Swedish company. It's a Swedish company that makes vodka, Absolut vodka, right? And so they decided they would be provocative and say, in an absolute world, Mexico would get its territory back, right? And America would be partitioned into the United States and Mexico, right? And this was published. In an absolute world in which, you know, vodka is consumed, you would see the so-called Reconquista, or reconquest, of the territories that Mexico lost in the U.S.-Mexican War of 1848. This was published in L.A. Times, Los Angeles newspaper, and, you know, people just laughed at it, ha ha ha, right? Although there are some people, I would say, in the United States, on the right, who take these kinds of things very seriously. Why? America's changing demographically. There's a term which has racialized connotations almost anywhere, but especially is very interesting from an Indian perspective, I would say. The browning of America. America's becoming more brown. Why? Because of the growth of the minority populations and the decline of the so-called white Protestant mainstream, if you like. So by 2040, America will reach the so-called majority-minority status, in which, you know, minorities will have far more representation and far more power, if that representation translates into power, than today or at any other point in American history. So, you know, what does this mean politically? Some people on the right would say we should be very serious about outcome of this type, you know, and that usually translates as an attempt to prevent the Spanish language from being officially institutionalized, codified in schools and government, etc. So, constitutionally speaking, the United States doesn't have a single language. You know, nowhere in the Constitution is it is it specified that U.S. is an English-speaking country, which, you know, opens space for a kind of political participation of people who would perhaps like the U.S. to become a bilingual state, much like there are many other bilingual or multilingual countries in the world. Is this going to be likely? I would say no, but again, it's part of a way of seeing the American decline as falling apart as opposed to something else. And then you'll have a lot of foreigners who are perhaps not pro-American, who perhaps like to engage in thinking about the United States that falls apart for good. So this is a Russian professor, Igor Panarin. He came up with his own map of the United States of the future. This is the US of 2050, in which there's the Californian Republic, part of China or under Chinese influence, Central North American Republic under Canadian influence, Atlantic America that may join Europe, and something called the Texas Republic, right? And he publishes this stuff. You know, he's been publishing for years. And what's the reaction in the United States? You know, the Wall Street Journal carries this story, you know, somewhere in comic book pages, right? I mean, is this the kind of response? How could you even possibly contemplate something like, you know, America that disintegrates? Which gives you an idea of the strength of this country, right? You know, if you look, what are the ways in which, you know, we study resources and capabilities and strengths of nation? Well, we'll get into that next. But I just want you to think about that when it comes to falling apart, this argument never applies. And if it applies, it's purely for entertainment. Okay. The second discursive perspective is this falling short idea. We are falling short. Falling short of what? Or before what? Before our past, our own past, our own promise. It's a very interesting part of American declinist discourse, and it goes all the way back to the beginning. I'm a Foucauldian myself, so I stay away from these origins debates. I try not to identify, oh, X began at time zero. It's very hard to say, oh, America began at the War of Independence, right? The way I see it, there's been an Anglo-America for a long time, and if you use a state-nation perspective, you will lose sight of a reality that's been with us for a very long time, for the past 300 years. I call that reality the Anglosphere. That's the subject of my other research that I won't be talking about today, but I will be staying away from identifying, you know, when did America begin. You know, you can think of its political development as being broader and deeper than simply independence, the War of Secession. If you're a British person, you would say that. So, there's something called Jeremiad or Jeremiad. I don't know if you've heard of this term. I included this Oxford English Dictionary definition of it. It's a lamentation, speech in a strain of grief or distress, a doleful complaint, a complaining tirade. And all these books here, these are just the recent ones that, you know, happen to be on my shelf back in my office. They talk about a certain rhetorical device whose very purpose is to say we used to be much better than we are, or we are not meeting the promise of our forefathers or those who have imagined this new city, shining city upon the hill. This goes to the Puritan era. You know, Puritans were people who basically took up from Europe, sailed into the Plymouth Harbor and created this shining city upon the hill, the new Zion, right? America had strong religious origins, if you like. Jeremiah was one of the 16 prophets of the Old Testament, and basically what he was saying, he basically predicted the fall of Jerusalem. Why? Because the Israelites were breaking with the covenant God. The fall of Jerusalem was the result. He also said there'll be a new golden age. Right? If you're an evangelical American person, you actually take these things very seriously. Evangelicals are also sometimes American presidents. George W. Bush, as some of you may know and have read about, was very, very seriously buying the evangelical discourse. That explains all kinds of, I would say, all kinds of American foreign policy understandings and directions. Jeremiah has been in the United States from the beginning. Even when the United States was doing really well, whatever that time point in time is, there have been people, political office holders, who would be saying we're falling short of our promise. Why? Because we are supposed to be the last best hope of humankind. These are Lincoln's words. Those words can you can trace them back to John Winthrop. John Winthrop was the founder of the Plymouth Colony. And essentially, what this does, I'll give you another example. So here you have a book about the African American Jeremiah. If you remember an event in 2008, how did Obama become No Drama Obama? His personal pastor was Jeremiah Wright. Jeremiah Wright, as the name implies. And what did he say? 9/11 is chickens coming home to roost. Right? We brought this upon ourselves. It's not God bless America, it's God damn America. Right? What happened, right? What happened next? How could Obama have a pastor that talks like this? This is anti-Americanism at its worst. What Obama did essentially was to give up to say goodbye to his long-time pastor and friend. You can't be my personal religious interlocutor because of speeches like this, of this kind. Essentially, this is a public relations nightmare. How could you have anyone saying 9/11 was caused by us, right? What he was saying is, he was actually speaking in an African American tradition of Jeremiah. Essentially, you know, we could be so much more than we already are. Wasn't even a political statement as a way of talking. And the purpose of that talk is essentially to galvanize the American public or the American society into action such that current challenges and challengers are overcome, right? And he was speaking within a community, an African American community of South Chicago, in which this discourse is fairly normal and it's localized. This is not about world politics, right? This is not about conspiracy theories. This is just a way of talking and making sure that people keep their head focused on what matters in life, collectivity, you know, improvement, detriment, and so on. And yet, you know, you can't have this on YouTube, right? You can't have this when Obama is trying to win the election. So Obama became No Drama Obama because he didn't want drama. He didn't want to explain to people that Jeremiah means something completely different. It's not a statement on, you know, what America got, what it deserved. So it's a way of talking about our own history, and our own history is storied, right? And yes, I mean, this is just an example. As I mentioned, you must have read these books as well, Chalmers Johnson's, Michael Mandelbaum. All of these can be seen as Jeremiads themselves. Now, none of these people are saying, oh, you know, the U.S. is done. We're falling behind. We better learn Mandarin. No one's saying that. They wouldn't be writing these books if they thought, you know, the future is closed, right? I mean, this is an exercise of agency. I'm going to write a book to show my compatriots that we're in a lot of trouble, and I'm going to include a chapter in which I outline what we should do in order to get back to where we are and where we should be. And that where we should be is top of the world, right? American exceptionalism. You can't possibly deny American exceptionalism if you're an American politician. Obama goes around the world, and the first thing he gets from European journalists usually is, what do you think of American exceptionalism? And in the United States, that's simply assumed, right? How can you have a president who doesn't believe in the exceptional nature, you know, the chosenness of our nation, the chosenness of our people? You know, the new Israel, the Zion. I mean, all of these are Christian discourses or Judeo-Christian discourses that go way back. Predate America as an idea, as a possibility. So you have to kind of pay at least some lip service to it. So what did Obama say in Paris 2008? He said, well, I believe the Americans are exceptional, the way that a Greek president would say that Greeks are exceptional, or the British president would say, Prime Minister, the Brits are exceptional. He kind of relativized it, right? And another public relations nightmare. How could you say that? The Greeks and the Brits should know that we are the exceptional nation, not them or whoever else. So usually what you have is, you know, people on the left, people on the right who became left, like Chalmers Johnson, would then, you know, engage in this discourse, use some of the same rhetorical devices that are religious in nature, if you like, in order to make points that are political or essentially responding to the politics of the day. So that leads me to the third kind of aspect of this discursive analysis of declinism, which is falling behind, right? America's falling behind. What does that really mean? Here's a barometer. It's like an industry right now, especially in the United States. There's so many blogs, websites, books being written about American decline. Decline Watch is the name of one blog. So you have a barometer. We're totally screwed. We better start learning Mandarin. Being superpower is nice while it lasted. You know, stay calm and carry on. Decline, we're going to be just fine. And USA, USA. So you can probably map an argument on this left-right continuum or optimistic pessimistic continuum and say, you know, where is Mandelbaum's book, where is Chalmers Johnson's books or so on. So this is where the current debate I think focuses. It's not about falling apart, which is seen as, you know, completely out of the ballpark. It's not Jeremiah. You have to kind of understand American political development, specifically its society, in order to understand the message of the Jeremiah. But everyone understands this, falling behind China, right? Everyone understands this. I mean, any election, presidential election, the topic is outsourcing, Chinese military, what are we going to do about this? Are they overtaking us? Dollar, right? China's undervaluing its currency, not playing fair. I mean, this is the currency of American politics come election time. So, what I want to do next is actually talk about this third and last aspect of declinism, which is America falling behind China. And how do we know? How will we know it if it is? And what does it mean if it does? Okay. So, what's important to understand, this is where the title for the lecture comes from, The Chronicles of Decline Foretold, is that this is nothing new. When it comes to the third aspect of the declinist perspective, essentially what you have is waves or cycles of declinism, right? Sputnik, if you watch Hollywood movies about American political history, there's always a scene in which, you know, some CIA officer is running down the hall and saying, the Russians are in the space, right? How could this happen? How could they overtake us technologically? What's the result? We're in decline. We should do something about this. What are we going to do? We're going to train people in science and engineering. And guess what? That's exactly what the United States does. You have, you know, a much greater emphasis on mass education and higher education in the late 50s. And then the 70s come after the OPEC crisis, right? Here the X is not the Soviet Union, it's Japan. Herman Kahn wrote a book, The Japanese Superstate. The world is run from the University of Tokyo and the Ministry of Finance in Tokyo as well. Essentially, when you look at the economic power, specifically wealth creation, even more specifically competitiveness and productivity, the Japanese are overtaking us almost in every possible way, right? We should be worried about Japan, not the Soviet Union. Let's do something about that. And so it's 1970s, right? I don't know if some of you study international relations here. International relations theory usually comes in three flavors or four flavors: realism, liberalism, constructivism / radical perspectives. So liberalism, one of the statements of neoliberal institutionalism, is Robert Cohen. His 1984 book, you may have seen it, it's titled After Hegemony. Hegemony ended in 1970s, right? There's no question mark after hegemony, right? He's talking about a perspective in which the United States is already very weak, right? And is this true? No, of course not. You know, well, where's Japan now, right? Look at them now. Right before the end of the Cold War, another wave of declinism. Kennedy's rise and fall. Have you read this book? It's very popular in the Western world. In fact, you could probably think of Paul Kennedy as the Gibbon of the 1980s. So when Gibbon wrote The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, this is at the high point of the Age of Empires, he wasn't really writing about the Roman Empire, it was about the British Empire, right? The Brits were debating their own decline at the turn of the 20th century. So Kennedy could be seen, as the new Gibbon. He was writing about the rise and fall of great powers across history, you know, 500-600 years. But really, the debate was about the United States. It was about American decline. It was one of the most popular books, still is in so many ways, for those who like history or books about history. And so These waves or cycles of declinism, guess who was one of the first theorists or people who saw it as a reoccurrence? Samuel Huntington. You know Huntington from various other perspectives. But basically, it was he was saying that this can only be good for us. Why? It's a neurosis that can be productive. It's kind of like feeling anxiety before exam. A little bit of anxiety is a good thing, right? Makes you focus, makes you study harder, makes you, you know, be more productive. This neurosis or anxiety works at the level of the state or a nation because it makes the American society become even more competitive, even more productive, do something about its perceived decline vis-a-vis other powers, Soviet Union, Japan, or the rest of the world. Okay, this is history. You know, past performance does not tell us anything about future performance. So any time you invest money, that's exactly what you get from a mutual fund advisor. I don't know if you're into that, but you know, those of you who study finance and political economy know exactly, right? Past performance can be extremely misleading. So, is it different today? That would be an intellectual question to ask. Now, once you ask that question, you simply have to study power, the concept of power. Well, how do you conceptualize power? Without an organizing idea of power and what it means to you, you can't possibly engage in this debate, right? Is the United States declining in relative terms? Well, yes, if we you know, pick a certain set of measurements and try to rank into those measurements and then try to conclude as to what this means in terms of this big political question, you know, are we declining? If so, what we should do? So, falling behind China, for example. Very few people are worrying about India. There's maybe one book in which says, yes, we're both democracies, but you know what? That doesn't mean anything. If the democratic piece is wrong, we might become rivals, right? The only one book out of 150, you know, on China, in which, you know, China is clearly the great power to worry about. So I'll talk about China a little bit. I'm not, obviously, a China expert. You have more than a few China experts here at Jamia. Talk to them. But I'll say what I have to say, 5 minutes. So, PRC worries a lot of Americans. I mentioned this earlier. The election, there's all kinds of China talk going on. Why population in terms of exports, car market, carbon emitter, consumer of energy, development story in history, buyer of U.S. Treasury bonds. This leads to all kinds of interesting perspectives. Whether really we should be worrying about them or thanking them. Holder of exchange reserves, military force spender, Blue Water Navy spender. You could find sizzling statistics almost in any news magazine, newspaper, blog worth its salt in the United States and elsewhere. I mean, their entire websites, The Economist, for example, devoted to, you know, tracing the moment where China will be overtaking the United States in terms of the size of its economy. Some people argue that already happened. But yeah, I mean, you get the idea. 10 years ago, none of this was part of political discourse because China was nowhere there. And yet you have titles like When China Rules the World and so on. So, you know, this is from an Indian perspective also a daily political occurrence. I mean, I come from IDSA. Trust me, there's a lot of talk of China and the China's rise and what it all means for India. So this is purely an American story. I'll stick to an American story. But in Q&A, if you want, I'd be more than happy to hear what you think about India in all of these terms. Okay, I don't know if you've seen this graph. So one of the biggest dirty secrets of political science is that politics is about power. Power is kind of like money to economics. And yet we don't have a good definition of power. I mean, I'm sure you've all come across all kinds of claims and counterclaims, how power can be conceptualized and why. And I'd be happy to talk about nothing but power in Q&A, but I'll give you a graph which takes power as granted. So we all assume, hypothetically speaking, that we know what the definition is. We have a sense of what power is. Units of power are these. This is time. And the graphs show the idea and practice, or the idea and reality of a tipping point. Those of you who are in finance know exactly what I'm going to say next. So here you have two states, A and B. So A, they start at the same point. So in terms of units of power, the blue, United States, has hundreds, 100 units of power at time zero, at year zero. China, or the state B, has 10 units of power at the same time. Now, in terms of growth of that power, the blue, the United States, grows at 5% a year. China grows at 10% a year, right? So you observe what happens over the course of 36 years. So the absolute difference between the United States and China is expanded, right? Is expanding. Now, that works really well for 36 years, but this is a simple arithmetical equation. I mean, this is not me putting a graph just to make a point. This is how tipping points work. So in year 36, if you're in the United States, you are not necessarily seeing your own decline. Why? Because the absolute difference between you and the competitor is so huge, right? Give it two or three more years, because the red is growing at a higher rate than you in terms of, in absolute terms, or in, also in terms of the portion, so the percentage of the power of the United States versus the power of China, let's say, blue versus red, is converging. You, in year 36, 37, 38, will basically sink like a stone. This is how tipping points work. So a lot of people who worry about American decline will say, we're right here. We don't see it because we don't understand that it's about growth rates, not about absolute differences. They're growing at a much faster rate. We're growing at a smaller rate. Eventually, not only will they catch up, but they will overtake us, and we will sink. And this will be a problem. Why? Because we're exceptional. That would be one argument, but there are others. So it's a simple mathematical relationship, right? If we all agree what power means, but we don't. It's very hard to conceptualize power, right? That's why we talk about hard power, soft power. Bourdieu talks about symbolic capital, economic capital, cultural capital. There are many ways to differentiate this this concept, right? And perhaps if I have time, how am I doing in terms of time? Is there?
I think 5-10 minutes.
Yeah, 5-10 minutes. Okay. So in the Q&A, I can maybe talk about the concept of power some more. But this is the idea. You know, China is growing. The growth rate of China is higher than our growth rate. Eventually, not only will they catch up, but they will overtake us. And so let's use some real data. This is International Monetary Fund. It comes from a dissertation by a student. His name is Michael Beckley. Basically, what he did was just mapped absolute differences between U.S. and China incomes per capita. So the absolute difference is the blue line. Of course, you know, China with its 10,000 per capita is lower than America's, you know, 45,000 per capita. The difference is high. That if you're just looking at the absolute difference, the United States is doing pretty well, right? In fact, you could argue that China is declining vis-a-vis the United States, not the United States vis-a-vis China, just if you're looking at the blue line. But if you're looking at the ratio, right, fraction of the United States, China's income per capita as a fraction of the United States, you see a slight rise, right? So what he's saying is that how you define decline essentially makes you see different things. If you're just looking at absolute difference, the United States is not declining. If you're looking at the ratio, the United States is also not declining, because this is not too scary, right? So his critics would say, okay, that's great. That's great. You know, you're looking at absolute differences in income per capita. If you look at the purely GDP in absolute terms, you would also see a similar line in which, you know, the United States is, that ratio of Chinese to U.S. wealth is growing. Real GDP per capita, so this is essentially Beckley's own line, seems to be going in the hypothesized direction as well. But if you're looking at the GDP per capita in purchasing power parity terms, that convergence or that growth is growing. You know, the ratio of American power held by China seems to be growing. Now, these are the graphs you'll see almost anywhere, right? The Economist will publish them every year, at least once. So I would say this is great, but this is a very narrow conception of power, right? We're talking still about economic power, and we're playing with two figures, GDP per per capita, and then GDP per capita at DPP. So maybe three different figures. But what is power, right? Power is such a larger, more expansive concept. That's why perhaps, you know, it behooves us to look at other perspectives, perhaps something like this, soft power. You must have come across the idea of soft power, making yourself attractive. So the ability of A to make itself attractive to B such that B changes its own preferences towards A. It's a very different definition of power from the standard in the European tradition. You would call it the Aristotelian or Dalian definition. What is power? Power of A. The power is the ability of B to make of A. Sorry, the ability of A to make B do what B otherwise would have not done. Right? Purely compulsory, direct action-reaction story. Soft power is somewhat more expansive. And the story here is China attractive to the rest of the world the way the United States is attractive to the rest of the world? Right? It's always relative. It has to be relative. So my question is to you is, where is the closest Confucius Institute to Jamia? I mean, if I'm to go to a Confucius Institute to learn about China, where would I go? Can anyone tell me? Where is it?
We don't have any such thing.
There's no such thing? China is supposed to build 1,000 Confucius Institutes by 2020. There are a few in Delhi, according to Wikipedia. I looked it up last night. I can't tell you how to get there, but there are some, right? So the problem is that we don't know where they are. Why? They're new. Okay, I grant you that. It's freshly established. But also, why would you go there? If you know, the story is some kind of a cultural story, you know, they're going to try to tell you, here's how you can study Mandarin. You know, classes are from Monday to Friday at these times. Not a lot of people are necessarily interested in this kind of stuff, right? In Canada, it's the same story. Students love to go to India, would love to go to, I don't know, Thailand. But when it comes to China, it's not as attractive as you would think the second largest or the next global power should be attractive, right? Why? Well, there are all kinds of explanations. The political explanation likes to, you know, stress, you know, authoritarian nature of its government. Some environmentalists might say, well, you know, it's not attractive because you can't breathe if you go to China. There's a linguistic perspective as well. Are Confucius Institutes going to be English-speaking or Mandarin-speaking? If they're English-speaking, they might draw more people in. But are they going to be talking about China, or are they going to be spreading someone else's values? Right? So the only book that I could find on this subject is Joshua Kurlatsnik's Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World. It should be read in conjunction with David Chambaud's Partial Power, which he says that China is lots of potential there, but it's a partial power. Why? Because it lacks legitimacy, it lacks soft power, right? It's not as attractive as the United States is, or the United States has been. So the point, I guess, here is this. The United States may be, and probably is, in relative decline vis-a-vis China, but it's still in an extremely strong position, right? It's not, perhaps, we can't talk about the unipolar world, but we can talk about the dominance, not superiority, not the mastery, not full spectrum dominance. A certain kind of dominance of the world system in a way perhaps that's lower now than it used to be 10 or certainly 30 years ago, but nonetheless still extremely advantageous to the United States. So when you're talking about decline, it's not about, you know, falling apart, it's not about falling short, it's not about falling behind China. It's simply weaker, not weak. Is this something that we're happy about? Define we, Canadians, Indians, Indians on the left, Indians on the right, Indians of the new generations, Indians of the older generation. That's a normative debate, that's a political debate. But analytically speaking, I would say there's not much evidence of a precipitous decline of the United States. It's a completely overblown concept, sold and peddled by American pundits who have an agenda. That agenda is more exceptionalism in the world. And so I'll give you one last slide, which is Gallup survey of various societies around the world. Where do you want to go if given an opportunity, if given a job or whatever? Where would you move? So they ask people all over the place. Top desired destinations are the US, Canada, UK, France, Spain, Saudi Arabia, Germany, and Australia. China doesn't even show up in these things. No one wants to move to China, right? That could be an indicator of the lack of soft power. once this changes, if it changes, historically, it was a fact, right? There was something called the Sinocentric International System. It was also a tributary system. If you wanted education, you learned Chinese, you went to Beijing, etc. Right? We're talking about, you know, Qing and Ming dynasties and what came before that. But not anymore, right? You almost always get stories like these. United States, for most people, most places of the world, most of the time is the most attractive society to move to. So, decline, schmeckline, we're fine. That would be the American conclusion. I'll stop here, and let's open it up for Q&A. And I'm more than happy to expand on any of these points, but also more than that, much excited about your own comments.